From Elmhurst Public Library, this is Storytime for Grown-Ups. Stories have the power to inspire and change us. Being read to stimulates our brains, expands our imaginations, and is just plain fun. I'm Margie Kohlbacher. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 1. Today we'll hear two stories by masters of the short fiction form. Our first piece is titled A Work of Art by Anton Chekhov. Chekhov was a playwright and short story writer in Russia in the late 1800s. He actually went to medical school and considered his work as a physician his primary career. However, because out of compassion, he tended not to charge his patients any fees, he wrote stories to earn a living. Sit back, listen, and enjoy.
A Work of Art by Anton Chekhov. Sasha Smirnov, the only son of his mother, holding under his arm something wrapped up in number 223 of the Financial News, assumed a sentimental expression and went into Dr. Kostyukov's consulting room. "Ah, dear lad," was how the doctor greeted him. "Well, how are we feeling? What good news have you for me?" Sasha blinked, laid his hand on his heart, and said in an agitated voice, "Mama sends you her greetings to you, Ivan Nikolovich, and told me to thank you. I am the only son of my mother, and you have saved my life. You have brought me through a dangerous illness, and we do not know how to thank you." "Oh, nonsense, lad," said the doctor, highly delighted. "I only did what anyone else would have done in my place. I am the only son of my mother. We are poor people and cannot, of course, repay you, and we are quite ashamed, doctor. Although, however, Mama and I, the only son of my mother, earnestly beg you to accept, in token of our gratitude, this object, which, an object of great value, an antique bronze, a rare work of art."
"Oh, you shouldn't," said the doctor, frowning. "What's this for?"
"No, please, do not refuse," Sasha went on muttering as he unpacked the parcel. "You will wound Mama and me by refusing. It's a fine thing, an antique bronze. It was left to us by my deceased father, and we have kept it as a precious souvenir. My father used to buy antique bronzes and sell them to connoisseurs. Mama and I keep on the business now."
Sasha undid the object and put it solemnly on the table. It was a not very tall candelabra of old bronze and artistic workmanship. It consisted of a group. On the pedestal stood two female figures in the costume of Eve, and in attitudes for the description of which I have neither the courage nor the fitting temperament. The figures were smiling coquettishly, and altogether looked as though, had it not been for the necessity of supporting the candlestick, they would have skipped off the pedestal and have indulged in an orgy such as improper for the reader even to imagine. Looking at the present, the doctor slowly scratched behind his ear, cleared his throat, and blew his nose irresolutely.
"Yes, it certainly is a fine thing," he muttered. "But how shall I express it? It's not quite for family reading. It's not simply décolleté, but beyond anything, dash it all."
"How do you mean?"
"The serpent tempter himself could not have invented anything worse. Why, to put such a phantasmagoria on the table would be defiling the whole flat."
"What a strange way of looking at art, doctor," said Sasha, offended.
"Why, it is an artistic thing. Look at it. There is so much beauty and elegance that it fills one's soul with a feeling of reverence and brings a lump into one's throat. When one sees anything so beautiful, one forgets everything earthly. Only look, how much movement, what an atmosphere, what expression!"
"I understand all that very well, my dear boy," the doctor interposed. "But, you know, I am a family man. My children run in here. Ladies come in."
"Of course, if you look at it from the point of view of the crowd," said Sasha, "then this exquisitely artistic work may appear in a certain light. But, doctor, rise superior to the crowd, especially as you will wound Mama and me by refusing it."
"I am the only son of my mother. You have saved my life. We are giving you the thing most precious to us, and I only regret that I have not the pair to present to you.
Thank you, my dear fellow. I am very grateful. Give my respects to your mother, but really, consider my children run in here. Ladies come. However, let it remain. I see there's no arguing with you.
And there is nothing to argue about, said Sasha, relieved. Put the candlestick here, by this vase. What a pity we have not the pair to it. It is a pity. Well, goodbye, doctor.
After Sasha's departure, the doctor looked for a long time at the candelabra, scratched behind his ear, and meditated.
It's a superb thing. There's no denying it, he thought. And it would be a pity to throw it away, but it's impossible for me to keep it. Here's a problem. To whom can I make a present of it, or to what charity can I give it?
After long meditation, he thought of his good friend, the lawyer, Yuhov, to whom he was indebted for the management of legal business.
Excellent, the doctor decided. It would be awkward for him as a friend to take money from me, and it will be very suitable for me to present him with this. I will take the devilish thing. Luckily, he is a bachelor and easygoing.
Without further procrastination, the doctor put on his hat and coat, took the candelabra, and went off to Yuhov's.
How are you, friend? He said, finding the lawyer at home. I've come to see you, to thank you for your efforts. You won't take money, so you must at least accept this thing here. See, my dear fellow, the thing is magnificent.
On seeing the bronze, the lawyer was moved to indescribable delight.
What a specimen, he chuckled. Ah, deuce, take it, to think of them imagining such a thing. The devils! Exquisite! Ravishing! Where did you get hold of such a delightful thing?
After pouring out his ecstasies, the lawyer looked timidly towards the door and said,
Only you must carry off your present, my boy. I can't take it.
Why? Cried the doctor, disconcerted.
Why? Because my mother is near all times, my clients. Besides, I should be ashamed for my servants to see it.
Nonsense, nonsense. Don't you dare to refuse, said the doctor, gesticulating. It's piggish of you. It's a work of art. What movement? What expression? I won't even talk of it. You will offend me.
If one could plaster it over or stick on fig leaves.
But the doctor gesticulated more violently than before, and dashing out of the flat, went home, glad that he had succeeded in getting the present off his hands. When he had gone away, the lawyer examined the candelabra, fingered it all over, and then, like the doctor, racked his brains over the question of what to do with the present.
It's a fine thing, he mused, and it would be a pity to throw it away and improper to keep it. The very best thing would be to make a present of it to someone. I know what. I'll take it this evening to Shashkin, the comedian.
The rascal is fond of such things, and, by the way, it is his benefit tonight. No sooner said than done. In the evening, the candelabra, carefully wrapped up, was duly carried to Shashkin's. The whole evening, the comic actor's dressing room was besieged by men coming to admire the present. The dressing room was filled with the hum of enthusiasm and laughter, like the neighing of horses. If one of the actresses approached the door and asked, "May I come in?" the comedian's husky voice was heard at once.
No, my dear, I am not dressed.
After the performance, the comedian shrugged his shoulders, flung up his hands, and said,
"Well, what am I to do with the horrid thing? Why, I live in a private flat. Actresses come and see me. It's not a photograph that you can put in a drawer."
"You had better sell it, sir,"
the hairdresser who was disrobing the actor advised him.
"There's an old woman living about here who buys antique bronzes. Go in and inquire for Madame Smirnov. Everyone knows her."
The actor followed his advice. 2 days later, the doctor was sitting in his consulting room and with his finger to his brow was meditating on the acids of the bile. All at once, the door opened, and Sasha Smirnov flew into the room. He was smiling, beaming, and his whole figure was radiant with happiness. In his hands, he held something wrapped up in newspaper. "Doctor," he began breathlessly, "imagine my delight. Happily for you, we have succeeded in picking up the pair to your candelabra. Mama is so happy. I am the only son of my mother. You saved my life." And Sasha, all of a tremor with gratitude, set the candelabra before the doctor. The doctor opened his mouth, tried to say something, but said nothing. He could not speak.
Our second piece today is called The King by Max Brand. Max Brand, whose real name was Frederick Schiller Faust, worked in Hollywood in the early 1900s and wrote under many pen names. His pen name Max Brand became best known for Westerns and the Dr. Kildare stories, a fan favorite. Faust left Hollywood to work as a war correspondent in Italy and was killed in 1944. Today's story was found among his papers. Sit back, listen, and enjoy.
The King by Max Brand. It was a big day when Rudy Zandor consented to dine with me at Chasen's, because those were the years when he was astonishing Hollywood with a series of super productions. He was another Samson whose strength lay not in his long hair, but in his perfect self-confidence. The country he loved, the flag followed, the god he worshipped, was Rudy Zandor. So I put in the whole day working on my plot and reached the restaurant rather full of hope. Zandor was hardly an hour later, which seemed a good sign, and then he came in with a yes man named Greg and Jimmy Jones, whose real name is Janaski. Zandor raised quite a buzz with his entrance because he always dressed for public appearances. This time he wore corduroy trousers, a riding coat buttoned high around the throat, and 4 days' whiskers. His friends were in dinner jackets for contrast. Rudy was almost at my table when another murmur started. All eyes left him, and in came Raymond Vincent Etherton in his black coat and white stock, like an 18th century ghost. It was rather hard on Zandor to have his entrance messed up like that, for he was completely forgotten as the old man went by looking straight ahead and failing to see the people who spoke to him. He went to his usual corner, waited for his coffee and cognac, and contemplated the dignity of space. When Dave Chasen in person brought the brandy, Etherton became gently and kindly aware of him, for he was really abstracted, not merely high hat. 30 years before, when he consented to be King Arthur for D.W. Griffith, he must have been a glorious man. Some of the glory hung about him as Henri Quatre in Ivry, or as Richard the Lionhearted in The Talisman. He never was cast except as a king, and he moved through his parts without the slightest acting, merely lending his presence, as it were. The whisper had it that there was a dash of real royalty in his blood, but no one even in Hollywood dared to suggest the bar sinister to Etherton. Even Hollywood was surprised by the appearance of such a man on the screen. He was more a rare legend than a fact. That was why Chasen's buzzed so this evening. Zandor, in eclipse, looked pretty sour. "That man," he said, pointing at Etherton. "Who is he?" Jimmy Jones winked at me. It was the yes man who gave the answer. A celebrity in Hollywood can't help accumulating them as the north side of a tree gathers moss. "That's Raymond Vincent Etherton," said Greg. "I want him. He has a hungry look. I want him to play Shylock," said Zandor. "The Merchant of Venice after the big Western?" I asked. "Before," said Zandor. "I'm not doing the Western." My hopes went crash, and at the same moment I heard Greg order caviar. Jimmy said, "You can't buy an Etherton, Rudy. He doesn't need money, but he acts now and then to raise the level of the screen and show the world what royalty should be." Zandor waved his hand at Jones. "You bother me," he said. "Go away." Jimmy Jones went away. "Now, get Etherton. Offer him $75,000, directed Zandor. His number two boy went over to Etherton, and I felt a little sick about Zandor and about myself for being with him. Etherton was sipping his brandy when the yes man leaned over his table and started talking. The old fellow showed no sign that he heard a syllable. Presently, he laid a bill on the table, stood up, and walked through the number two boy as though the fellow were a thin mist. He passed out of Chasen's, and Greg came back to Xandor, astonished.
Nothing could stop him. Not even your name, Rudy, he said.
Why didn't you raise the bid? Asked Xandor, furious. I don't care what sort of blood he has in him. Nobody walks out on me. Why didn't you offer him 100,000?
But I didn't have the authority, said the yes man.
Xandor looked him over from the chin to the sleek of his hair and turned his shoulder. It was plain that there was one parasite less in his life. It was a rotten dinner. I tried to be bright for a while, but gave it up after Xandor had snarled a few times. The great man was preoccupied. In the middle of his chicken cacciatore, he jumped up and left the tableware jingling.
Show me where this Etherton lives, he commanded.
I paid the bill and took him to Etherton's house. Small, sedate, withdrawn from the vulgar world behind a formal Italian garden. The California moon, for we have a special variety out here, was laying cool silver over everything, and the fountain statue left a perfect shadow on the pool. The door of the house was open. I don't know why this shocked me so much. It was like seeing the great Etherton with his mouth agape. Xandor leaned on the bell. It made a thin chime of music far inside, and we had no other answer. Xandor went in.
You'd better not do that, I protested. The old man won't stand intrusions.
Look, said Xandor. I knew it. Hungry.
I followed him a step and saw him pointing to the living room. There was enough slanting moonshine to show that it was empty. The wax floor shone like water, but there was not a stick of furniture. Xandor strode through the open door beyond and into the kitchen. There was a rusted gas stove. Something scurried away on a shelf, and I saw a bit of nibbled cheese rind and cracker crumbs. But Xandor was moving on through a naked dining room and into a bedchamber that was furnished with box springs on the floor, a pier glass, and a big gilded chair in front of the mirror. In the chair sat Etherton, wrapped in a black coat with his white head thrown back and his right hand at his breast, supported by something. He looked at us with deeply veiled eyes of contempt and seemed about to make a gesture of silent dismissal. It needed another glance to see that all his gesturing had ended. For what supported his hand was the hilt of the little medieval dagger he had driven through his heart. I looked away from him to the three big photographs which hung on the walls and showed me Etherton as the lion-hearted in heavy chain mail, as Henry Quatre with the famous white plume in his helmet, as King Arthur bearded like a saint. Understanding grew in me. Those rare appearances of Etherton on the screen had not been a casual amusement, but the nerve center of his whole life. His parts never had been large, but they had made him a king, and with a child's pitiful sincerity, he had enclosed himself within a dream. Rather than step outside it, he had starved. I could imagine with what care he dressed himself this evening, borrowed the last possible dollar from a pawnbroker, and went out for the final time to see if Hollywood once more would give him a shadowy throne. Instead, it preferred to see in him the wicked moneylender, so he came home and erased himself from the page. Xandor was triumphant.
"You see? You see?" he roared at me. I was right. I did spot the hunger in him. He's been on a throne for 30 years. But when he got the Shylock offer, he knew that I'd seen the starvation in his face. The 75,000 scared him. He was tempted, and he almost fell. The 100,000 would have bought him back, lock, stock, and barrel. But that fool of a Greg didn't know how to bargain.
I got out into the garden. It was a warm June night, but I was shivering. Xandor followed me. The bigness of his voice made the fountain pool tremble.
He wanted to be a king or nothing, you see, roared Zandor. So he came home and ended his reign. You get it? It's big stuff. It's new. It's a picture, and it's mine.
Thank you for listening today. Be sure to join us for our next episode of Mind Expanding Tales.
Storytime for Grownups is recorded at Elmhurst Public Library's Creative Studio Lab. Directed and edited by Jeremy Slayton. Produced and hosted by Margie Kohlbacher. Stories narrated by Duard Mosley. Works read in this podcast may be protected under copyright law. These podcasts are reserved for the education of library patrons only. Elmhurst Public Library receives no commercial gain from these recordings. No unauthorized further dissemination of these works is permitted.